This of the House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll of attendance.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Ellison.
Present.
Representative Feist. Representative Feist. Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Mueller. Representative Mueller. Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang excused. Representative Feist.
Present. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good. Thanks.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
That concludes roll call with 18 present.
Well, with 18 present, there is a quorum. Members, this hearing is being held remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, emergency house operations in response to the COVID-19 infectious disease pandemic requiring public health exercise of social distancing. The public can view House Rule 10.01 on the Minnesota House webpage. The public can also visit the committee page on the Minnesota House site for instructions on how to view proceedings via video, streaming video, as well as instructions on how to participate and sign up for public testimony. Our first order of business is pretty mundane, members. It's the adoption of minutes. We haven't done that for a little while, so we do have the minutes of March 18th, March 19th, and March 23rd, and I'm wondering if Representative Frazier would be so kind as to move adoption of those three sets of minutes.
Mr. Chair, I would absolutely move adoption of those three sets of minutes.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Johnson, voice vote, I take it, is fine.
Voice vote is fine.
Very well, thank you. All in favor of adoption of the minutes of March, of the Frazier motion to adopt the minutes of March 18th, 19th, and 23rd, please say aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes, minutes of March 18th, 19th, and 23rd are adopted. Members, we have four bills up before us today. I would like to preface our discussion today by encouraging members to, and we do this, but, you know, it's a reminder, you know, for members to engage with one another, respectfully stick to the issue in front of us. Some of the issues some folks may find sensitive, and it's important that we're focusing on the policy issues before us and not on personalities or anything like that. So with that, members.
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what's the path forward for these bills. We're past second deadline. This is the first time we're hearing policy bills. By the general rules of the House has been a policy bill has to be heard in at least one chamber before first deadline. Both chambers can be done by second deadline. And we're at the ending the coming up to the end of the first full week after second deadline. So I'm just wondering what's the purpose of hearing these, if they've gone to Rules Committee to come back to us as Rules have requested of them to be heard. Or is it just something to satisfy members of your own caucus to hear these bills?
Well, Representative Johnson, you've got several questions there. Let me ignore some of them, quite frankly, and just answer your technical question, which is our intent here is to hear these bills and move the first two, certainly to the Judiciary Committee. The issue of deadlines is an issue, as you well know, because you've served here for a long time, as I have, is something that the Rules Committee can deal with. And I fully expect that they'll be looking at these bills and acting accordingly. And so that's, you know, my hope is that we have a good conversation about really important issues in the state of Minnesota. With that, members, House File 1103 is the first bill up. It's by Representative Thompson. The chair moves to refer House File 1103 to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Thompson, welcome to the committee. I think this is the first time, I think, you've been here as an author of the bill. You have been here in the past as a pre-Representative Thompson age as an advocate on a number of issues. I recall some investment issues for youth intervention work last year or two that enjoyed some really good support. So I look forward to hearing about your bill and having a good conversation as well. There is an author's amendment that will shape the bill the way in which you have asked it to be heard today. And so if you wish, I can move that at this point. Representative Thompson.
I'm sorry, I was on mute, Chair. Yes, I would like you to move.
You know, you're the only one who's ever been on mute, you know. It happens on a daily basis. Very well, the chair moves to amend House File 1103 with the A1 amendment and author's amendment that shapes the bill up for our discussion today. Representative Johnson, you're okay with a voice vote, or do you want to roll on this?
We can just voice vote this one.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of the A1 amendment, adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted onto House File 1103. Representative Thompson, your bill as amended, the form you wish it to be today, tell us about your bill, and then you've got several testifiers, and then there are also additional public testifiers to your bill. Representative Thompson, welcome to the committee.
This is Bill 1103. This is a bill for an act relating to public safety imposing duties on police officers and law enforcement agencies regarding video and audio recordings, use of deadly force, providing for civil remedy, proposing coding for new law in Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 13. Chair, I want to share something real quick. July 5th of 2016, I stood outside of the store and I spoke to a great friend of mine. And we talked about the murder of Alton Sterling, who was murdered in Baton Rouge. And we shared the same sentiment that the video evidence would come out and nothing would happen as far as any type of accountability. And we were so numb to that police-involved shooting on that day, July 5th, 2016. The very next day, July 6th of 2016, my good friend was murdered within the same way we discussed outside of that store. Body camera footage came out, and it showed that there was negligence. There was a jumpy officer on the gun that ultimately killed my good friend, Philando Castile. And I came before this body asking for a lot of significant changes within policing, and we got implicit bias training and de-escalation training. We also got money for that training. And I feel like it was off the blood of Philando that we got this money for this training. And here we are, 2021. And we're looking at a training sergeant kill a young man by the name of George Floyd. Every year we're here, and we're here because of one reason, and that's bad policing. Not saying that all police officers are bad, but the bad ones are making the good ones look very bad. And so I'm here before this body today asking for exactly what the community that I serve need, and that's some changes within policing. And I have a lot of testifiers. And so for the sake of time, I want to leave it. I'm by no means a professional. I'm just a professional Black man. So I just want to leave it to the testifiers. If you will, Chair, because I don't want to take up all the time. It's not about me. I promised this body in 2016 that I would be the change I want to see. And here I am, because I was just like some of these testifiers just last year. Except for I really want to see change. I have never been more passionate about anything I've done in my life. Here I am before you, being the change I want to see in my community. I am a Minnesota legislator now. And so I want to say thank you, Chair, for the opportunity of hearing this bill and pass it over to Jonathan McCullough.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Thompson. Mr. McClellan, welcome to the committee. I obviously state your name for the record and give us your testimony, but let me ask you this, sir. If you could perhaps walk us very quickly through this bill. If not, I can certainly have our counsel do that. But you know, I prefer to hear from the public as much as possible. Mr. McClellan?
Yes. Chair and members, my name is Jonathan McClellan. I am a retired Minneapolis firefighter, retired due to an injury in the line of duty, saving a young man's life. I am president of the Minnesota Justice Coalition and law student at the University of St. Thomas. I would like to thank this committee for giving me an opportunity to share with you today. And I would like to thank Representative Thompson for carrying this important piece of legislation. The common thread that you hear throughout all the families' cases who lost loved ones to police violence is that the information is kept by law enforcement, and the information sought often stalls out potential cases, and the family is left to suffer not knowing what truly happened to their loved one. You should not have to wait 10 months or 11 years to know what happened when your loved one is killed. One case in particular which inspired this legislation is the case of Kobe Heisler. Kobe Heisler was a young autistic boy who was killed in his grandparents' home by law enforcement on August 31st, 2019, following a mental health incident. While meeting with many other families who lost loved ones at the hands of law enforcement, Kobe's mother, Amity, was notified that she would be allowed to see the footage of her son's death. This happened to be 1 week after the death of George Floyd. In early June 2020, almost 10 months after the death of Kobe, Amity was told that the only people that could see the law enforcement videos was her family, and then that changed the day of the schedule of the viewing. To add to her pain and grief of losing her son, Amity was overcome with grief to the point where she was unable to stand. She was not allowed a chance to properly grieve for her son because she was kept in the dark on what really happened. There are many similar cases when it comes to families requesting information. These families are put into a yo-yo trying to figure out what happened to their loved one, and oftentimes this goes on for years. In another case, we are still receiving contradictory information after 11 years of being told that it didn't exist. We were able to find a video. In a recent case out of Minneapolis, the police released one video to justify the killing of a man named Dalaad Eid, allowing that narrative to simmer in the community while holding on to all the cards, rebuffing the family's pleas for transparency and access to all the videos while the family is still grieving. And as a state, we can do better. On Saturday, March 20th, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman told a working group of 16, including Attorney General Keith Ellison and Minnesota Commissioner of Public Safety John Harrington, regarding any police-involved deadly force encounters, that any video related to the death of a citizen should be made public as soon as possible, but in all cases within 45 days of the incident. Taking this into consideration, we agreed to giving law enforcement 90 days to fully release the videos and audio to the family and or their legal representative. When law enforcement agencies withhold video evidence of police misbehavior, the other details concerning the deceased are usually released shortly after the incident. The decedent's prior criminal record, whether or not the person possessed drugs, the blood test results, and coroner's report are made available to the media. The priority of the families gets lost in this process, and that needs to change. Oftentimes, the video and or audio is released by law enforcement. It will be selective in spinning a narrative in the media that benefits one side. Oftentimes, these media dumps are misleading and cast a negative shadow on the person who was killed, forcing the families to fight an uphill battle to clear their loved one's name while trying to grieve. As part of his earlier statement, Mike Freeman said, "We share these remarks with a profound commitment to deal fairly, transparently, and as professionally as we can in each case. We assign our most experienced people to allocate all of the resources necessary to reach justice," end quote. These families need to be allowed to access this information to manage their trauma and pursue justice wherever it may come. This club's membership is unsolicited and paid for in tears and sometimes in blood. It is important to ensure that transparency and trust is the bedrock and or foundation of our government's institutions, and any opportunity we have to improve, we should. This bill will help advance those very principles that are a prerequisite for transparency and accountability to the families and communities in which they live. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McClellan. Next, we have Gregory Sisk from St. Thomas School of Law. If you can please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and give us your testimony.
If I may, real quick, Gregory will be Gregory will be testifying on the QI bill on 1104. Michelle Gross is the next testifier on this bill.
Okay, my notes are mixed up. Michelle Gross, if you can come forward, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Oh, had a John Thompson moment there. I was muted. My apologies. Chair Mariani and members, thank you for hearing from me this morning or this afternoon. I'm stuck on morning for some reason. My apologies. At any rate, what I wanted to speak about basically is the merits of this bill itself. And I think Mr. McClellan touched on those quite well in terms of giving the families some, you know, respite and some understanding of what happened to their family members. I work with a lot of these families. I've been doing work in this arena for about 35 years, and I work with many families of people who've lost their family members at the hands of law enforcement. Right or wrong, families want to know what has happened to their loved one. They can understand if the shooting was justified or the killing was in some way justified. They're capable of understanding that. But what they are not capable of is not knowing. And this is what is so excruciating to people. I work on a case, for example, of a few years ago in which the BCA had held all of the information under investigation for something like 14, 15 months. And this family was, including holding his body, by the way, for that period of time. And the family was left in the position of not being able to bury their loved one, not be able to understand what happened in the incident. These are just things that I think anybody that sits on this committee who has a loved one, who would lose a loved one and not understand the circumstances, could really relate to. It's really excruciating. I'm working with another family now that is being told that the investigation is not going to be complete, even though it's been under investigation for in the neighborhood of 5 years. And they were recently told that the data won't be made public because the statute of limitations is 30 years. And so this is, really wrong to to put these families through this kind of excruciating pain. I know that you received a letter from League of Minnesota Cities that talked about the need to balance the rights of the public versus the ability of law enforcement to conduct investigations. But what I want to point out about this bill is we're not asking that this video be made generally public, like that it be broadcast to the public. What we're asking for is for the families to have access to that video footage within a reasonable period of time. I want to read to you very briefly part of a ruling that we got in a case related to data that is supposed to be public at all times in critical incidents. And this was a ruling that was given to us by Judge Bridget Sullivan. And she says, and I quote, "The court notes for the record that these cases, officer-involved shootings, the reason for the public to have immediate access to specific information, such as the names of officers involved, are compelling. Our common humanity tells us we owe at least this much to the surviving family members." In her affidavit, Michelle Gross explains that one media strategy often used by law enforcement agencies in the immediate aftermath of officer-involved shootings is to vilify the victim. She explains that to be on a level playing field with such agencies, the families of those killed and the public must have immediate access to critical information about the shooting, The court agrees. The court is persuaded that the families of the dead and maimed are entitled to immediately know those responsible. And I think that's a really important recognition of the humanity of these families. I think about the case of George Floyd. While the video, the bystander video, was being shown on Facebook and all over the place, and people were looking at it, police information officer John Elder stood outside of City Hall in Minneapolis and said, in the course of an arrest this evening, a man had a medical emergency. Had there not been a bystander video, Mr. Floyd's family would unlikely know, even to this day, what had happened to their family member. And I think that's deeply unfair. It's, you know, we're trying to balance here, and I understand the need for police officers to investigate, but I recognize that families have needs too. And this law is too, the statute as it exists is too stilted toward law enforcement and does not recognize the humanity of the families involved. And so I ask for us to pass this particular bill in order to rebalance the legislation to take into account the needs of family members. And I thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Grills. Representative Thompson, do you have any other testifiers? These are the only two that I have listed.
No, we're open for questions, Chair.
All right, why don't we move on to the public testifiers. There are two that I have on the list. Chief Henthorne, I hope I pronounced your last name correctly, sir, from Richfield. If you can come forward, identify yourself for the record, and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members. My name is Jay Henthorne. I'm the Chief of Police of the City of Richfield, and it's always a pleasure to be here to testify in front of the Public Safety Committee. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, who represents more than 300 police chiefs across the state and over 150 command staff members. We do appreciate the changes and amendments to this bill, including but not limited to the possible 90-day timeframe to release the video publicly. However, the bill is modeled on Hennepin County's process, and being a chief in that county for the last 7 or 8 years, with full understanding that not all counties have that same process throughout the state. So I would like the committee to take that into consideration for all law enforcement agencies who have different processes. The Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association has significant concerns with House File 1103. Specifically, we believe this bill has the strong potential to undermine the integrity of the criminal investigations that follow an officer-involved shooting or other types of critical incidents. To be clear, the release of body cam or squad car video that shows the use of deadly force to a next of kin is vitally important to ensuring transparency. However, this video is considered evidence and needs to be handled properly as not to compromise the detailed investigation. These investigations are critically important phase for ensuring justice is served in the aftermath of an officer-involved use of deadly force, and we must appropriately balance the need for transparency and accountability with protecting the integrity and the quality of the investigation. Interviews of these directly involved and other key witnesses will usually not have taken place within 48 hours of the incident. These investigations need to be thorough and are extremely complex. And by releasing the video, the balance of protecting the integrity and quality of the investigation could be tainted, as the video could be made public without steps being completed prior to those interviews or statements being taken. Minnesota retention schedules already require us to retain data on body cameras and squad camera video. As CLIO's chief law enforcement officers, we are responsible to protect everyone's data. This includes private data as classified in Chapter 13.82, which consists of an active criminal investigative data as it relates to video footage taken by law enforcement, and CLIOs are mandated to protect this data to include redaction of private data as required by that Chapter 13, with video created by the law enforcement agency that is deemed not public. Lastly, I'd like to draw your attention to what the Working Group on Police Deadly Force Encounters recommended the legislature act on. Specifically, under Action Step 3.3.2, the report states that the legislature should research and evaluate the impact of body-worn cameras by 2022. If the evidence suggests they contribute to public safety and community trust, and provide valued deadly force encounters, the legislature should encourage and fund the full implementation of body-worn cameras statewide. Understanding that communities have local autonomy on the choice to adopt body-worn cameras, we would like the committee to work collaboratively with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police toward this goal that was agreed to by the working group. For these reasons, the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association strongly opposes House File 1103. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Hector. And sir, you can stick around for questions, I assume.
Correct, Chair Mariani, I can.
All right, very well. Thank you, Chief. Next, we have Tim Leslie, Dakota County Sheriff. Sheriff Leslie, please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and committee members. I'm Tim Leslie, the sheriff in Dakota County, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee again today. We're opposed for a variety of reasons. I'm representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and our opposition aligns with others who are also in opposition. I just want to bring up the fact that this body and the Senate worked painstakingly to come to together on 13.825, which governs the use of police-worn body cameras. And it was extensive, it was hard work, and I think this has been working well, obviously not perfect, because we wouldn't be here right now if it was perfect, but it does strike a balance with many things that we're trying to consider. The ability to share with others in a manner that done to protect the privacy concerns of family, witnesses, victims. We note that the bill offers an unedited version. We think of that as somewhat unrealistic and potentially dangerous, as it might expose others and allow for it to be released to the media ahead of a completed investigation. And that could have impacts on both the criminal proceeding and, as you are well aware, the employment proceeding, which is done separate from the criminal proceeding. Some of the events we've been involved in law enforcement over the course of time, we have 10 plus body cameras rolling at the scene, which requires extensive examination so as not to reveal uninvolved persons. And you want to protect those protections on those individuals. The timeline is somewhat arbitrary, the 48 hours all the way to the 90 days. We'd like to express some caution on that. Sometimes maybe the 48 hours could be met. Sometimes the 90 days could be met, but maybe not every time. Because of that, these are fact-specific, very detailed investigations. Staff-intensive, we want to properly document and capture what occurred. Superintendent Evans, if he was here testifying today, he'd be expressing that same concern. Once you release that scene, you never get it back again. You want to capture what occurred, and you want to get that scene locked down and make sure piece of evidence is captured. And trying to strike that delicate balance between that and those family considerations is really the goal. Subdivision 2 talks about the altered, erased, or destroyed prior to expiration. Just in case people didn't know, only myself and my designee have access to the body camera footage that occurs in the Dakota County Sheriff's Office. And I would welcome any members of the committee, Mr. Chair, to come down to Dakota County, sit over our shoulder, and I'll show you exactly what we see and how we control those body camera footage that we receive from our deputies that are on the road every day. The no redaction of officer language already exists in 13.825. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and thank you for that, Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. I don't have any other testifiers, Representative Thompson, so it seems like this is an appropriate time to open up for questions and comments from the committee. We do have Representative Rowley first. Representative Rowley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate it, and I want to echo the Chair's opening comments. This is the first time, Representative Thompson, you've been in front of our committee. We've not met yet. My name is Representative Donald Rowley, 38A. I represent Hugo, Minnesota. And the question that I've got relates to the combination of the A1 amendment to the actual language of the bill itself. So if we take a look at the bill, on line 1.21, and it starts at 1.20 to 2.1. It says, with a peace officer's portable recording system be altered. And it says at the beginning, under no circumstances may it be altered. And so the first question that I've got is understanding that when the recording is released, there are redaction requirements and there is ADA compliant requirements for things like subtitling of the words that are used in the video. Do you believe that, or how would we fix the bill in order to be able to allow things like ADA compliance to be applied to the particular bill, Mr. Chair?
Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Raleigh. My answer to your question is very simple. The public does not want the remixed version of these videos put out. The public wants clear, unedited video. We can tell when you pause and take something out and replace it with what you want to put in these videos to actually tell a story, you know, a lie, juicy. Truth don't sell. So we want the truth. We don't want an edited version. And I don't, you know, we can get into the details of Section 2, Section 3, Section 4, or any other sections, but my answer is going to be simple. Again, the public does not want this edited, remixed version to tell a story to protect bad officers. That's what we want. This profession, it's crucial to the integrity of this profession and the livelihood of this profession. We cannot keep protecting bad officers. We cannot. And so that's my answer.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was talking about ADA compliance. What happens if the person that is receiving the video has no hearing? Again, we've got ADA laws on the books specifically to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to be given the information in a way that they can comprehend.
Representative Raleigh, and obviously the bill is silent on the issue of ADA. I presume we can make all sorts of assumptions that, you know, there's certain, you know, levels of responsibilities for individuals with disabilities to be able to, you know, work with public information, but there are also protocols that exist in state and federal laws relative to information as well as physical accommodations relative to ADA. I would imagine that nothing, well, let me put it this way. I don't believe that anything in this bill will alter any of the existing protocols and statutes in state law. We can certainly turn to counsel to see if the chair might be barking up the right or wrong tree on that.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair,
if I'm silent on that issue.
Yeah, if I may, Mr. Chair, because my question was two parts, and ADA was one of them. The second part is the redaction that's needed. If a child, somebody that's under the, according to Minnesota statute, if a child is 13 or under, is included in the video and is not a material part of the investigation, does this in line 1.21 actually change the law by saying, and I'll read it here, under no circumstances? And what I fear, and again, this then will drive to the A1 amendment, which I'll address after this particular question, Mr. Chair.
Chair, if I would,
Representative Thompson,
I would honestly be happy to work with Representative Raleigh and work with law enforcement on this privacy issue that we're coming up, we're talking about now. I'd be happy to work on that, because that's something that we don't have, is a working relationship. The community always says, we don't want to work with the police. This is a certain community, and this is bad. You know, and so I'm offering that olive branch at all times, man. I am not hard to get along with. I'm somebody who's willing to work on it with you, because we have a problem, and that's my answer.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I will address the A1 amendment, and in the amendment, I'm going to pull this up. In the amendment, it says that all recordings of an incident where a peace officer used deadly force and an individual dies must be released to the individual's next of kin within 90 days. And then it also states that in the actual bill itself, in a different section, and I'm not going to call it the exact number because the point of it is, in part of the bill, it says that the amendment removed the words "or copy," and in the amendment, it says "must release." So how do we release something that hasn't been copied while also taking into account that the word "altered" says "may not under any circumstances be altered"? And Representative Thompson, I agree, in the spirit of working together and so forth, a lot of the role that I play is in looking at the enforceable language of it and making sure that we don't get into cyclical redundancy of allowing something in one part and not allowing it in another. And I truly believe that your bill creates a cyclically redundant portion with the addition of the A1 amendment from the standpoint of it requires that it's released within 90 days, but then says under no circumstances can it be copied because it utilizes the word "alter." And the definition of an alteration is material change from any state to another state. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thompson, you can certainly ask your testifiers if they have thoughts on this as well, but Representative Thompson. You might be muted, sir.
I wanted to also give Jonathan McCollum a chance to chime in, but these are great issues that we may need to look at in judiciary and data practices also. So I'll look at the language to see if we need to make any adjustments, but also I wanted to let Jonathan McCollum get a chance. We can talk, Representative Raleigh, but there are people here who are really passionate like myself, and I would like to give them a chance to speak on this also.
And it does seem that there might be a more judiciary jurisdiction issue here, but Mr. McCollum.
Representative Raleigh and Chair Mariani. Altered, as I take it, doesn't mean that it's been copied, or doesn't mean that it can't be copied. They're obviously with this bill, if a copy needs to be made, it can be copied, but it can't be altered. The copy that goes to after the 90-day expiration can go to the family. It can be a copy, but it can't be an altered copy of that footage, as I understand it.
Okay. Representative Raleigh, and then we do have a number of other of your colleagues with questions.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and this will be the last. I don't know if even this is a question, but I would point the author and the testifiers to the A1 amendment that in line 1.3 specifically called out page 2, line 18, and called to delete end copying. So I believe in my plain text reading of this and the amendment, it looked like copying was addressed and then had to be taken out for the very reasons of this cyclical redundancy. And that's where I guess I'll leave it, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for my indulgence.
Thank you, members, make sure you're muted at all times unless you're speaking, because we occasionally get some interruptions.
John Thompson.
Representative Nanati.
Was that for me, Chair Mariani?
Yes, and again, Representative Devaghi, I'd ask anyone on this call to please make sure you're muted because we are getting some interruptions here. We want to make sure we hear our members' questions and comments. Representative Devaghi.
Yeah, so Chair Mariani, and it's more of a comment because it was covered by both of the testifiers, and Representative Thompson has addressed it as well, but just from a practical standpoint, being involved in the redaction as a supervisor of video in the past in a deadly use of force, it is a long, drawn-out process, and I still think we want to keep provisions for that minors and unaffected witnesses. I think that's important, and that pixelation and redaction of some of those identities is important. We don't want to lose that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Michelle Wells did talk about the conversation. It's proper to have, you know, conversation around what the balance is with those, and I take it that's, what we're trying to do in this conversation and subsequent ones as well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, Representative Thompson, I understand what you're trying to do with this bill. I think in the long run, it's actually going to hurt the victims in some of these situations. Looking at it in that 48 hours, a lot of times it takes longer than that just to identify some of the people that could possibly be witness and to be able to talk to them to get an accurate statement from them. So that's a problem. But the current way, that, if I remember correctly, the way the current statute reads, in the interest of public safety, that video can already be released. It all depends on the circumstances and up to the jurisdiction that has copy of that. In a law enforcement-involved shooting, it's going to be the BCA, and the governor's going to have some say in if it gets released or not. So it's, but if the improper, if it's released, then it's, there's information on there that hasn't been, that could compromise the investigation there to get a true and accurate investigation. A lot of times they don't want to release that information and that video until they can verify and get in touch with the people. Or it might show some things that maybe only the one of the witnesses or even the perpetrator might have known in some of these situations, where they're careful to release investigative data unless it's in the best interest of the public. And that sometimes is a tough decision to make. We also, Representative Novotny brought up the fact of the 48 hours to just to redact the information. When we discussed this original bill and some of the body cam footage as well, besides the squad car video data in judiciary and civil law data practices, we learned that for about every minute of video that needs to be redacted, it could take up to 1 to 4 hours to redact it. And if you have 8 officers at a scene, all with body cameras, all with squad video, you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of hours of redacting of the video. So I think, personally, I like it best if it's the way this current statute reads, if it's in the interest of public safety. And we've had situations where the jurisdiction with the control of the video would have released it. We probably would not have had some of the incidents that we had. So I think it's important to look at the total circumstances involving of it, giving the local prosecutors a good judgment in what to do. Granted, sometimes I wonder in the judgment of some of the prosecutors with the decisions they make, but they generally, in these situations, it's an elected official, elected prosecutor, usually the county attorney. In some of these instances, it might be the elected official of the attorney general, whether it's released or not. But I think it should be left up to them if it's released or not. If overall, it has worked fairly well, especially in greater Minnesota, when they have or have not released the data, the proper information does come out. There has been situations on here where I know if the data, if it had been released to the public, things would not have happened. But there again, that's something you have to take up with your local prosecutors or, I don't think we've had any issues since the changes yet in, that we passed last year, that didn't pass, but I think it should be left up to local prosecutors, whether it should be released or not, because they have the best understanding of what's going on in their communities. Thank you.
Mariani, may I respond?
Well, Representative Johnson, no, Ms. Wells, so I want to move to a vote in the next few minutes here. I do appreciate your willingness to respond, but we've run over time. with three other bills before us. Representative Polston.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My question is a quick one, and it's for one of the chiefs. I am wondering if a chief of police or a county sheriff or any law enforcement, the head of any law enforcement division, has the discretion to watch, not turn over a video to a family, but to watch a video with a family. In other words, can a family member view a video in the presence of the sheriff or the chief of police?
About Chief Henthorn?
Yes, as the chief of police, and just to go back to what Sheriff Leslie talked about, our processes for review and redaction are the same. I mean, it's either done by myself with their IT staff or one of our other deputy chiefs. In a situation, we could sit down with the family to review the video. Again, I think you would still run into issues of redaction when it comes to the ADA requirements and or juveniles within the video.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Polston?
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chair Mariani.
Thank you. Good question. Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. I do share some of these concerns that we're seeing expressed here. Some of them have been involving minors, but you know, I was on the Civil Law Committee when we had discussions in the last several years in regards to the amount of time that body cam footage should be retained and when it should be deleted and things like that. And one of the scenarios that is can often be the case is in somebody's house, it's obviously very private, very personal. And we can imagine all kinds of scenarios where a law enforcement incident requires a law enforcement officer with a camera that's recording to enter into somebody's private home. And let's say everybody's an adult. Let's say it's multiple roommates. Let's say it's adult children, whatever the scenario might be. And let's say there's adult people that happen to be naked in the video. They might have gotten out of the shower, right? Maybe there was a call from another adult party in the house, and another adult was unaware of what was happening. They get out, and this is all caught on the video camera. That's private and personal, and they may have nothing to do whatsoever with any situation that might end up with the use of deadly force. Not even death, right? Because it's deadly force. I think is also, or is it just deadly force? Actually, I will ask that question, Mr. Chair. Is it involving just deadly force or death?
Representative Thompson.
The bill's read is deadly use of deadly force.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, so it's only deadly force. Okay, so imagine the scenario, though, where you have somebody who's in a compromised position who has nothing to do with the incident whatsoever. That unedited then is going to go. Mr. Chair, does the bill author see a concern with all kinds of scenarios where, since an unedited version has to be made available to other parties, that it might compromise the safety, security, the embarrassment of parties that may be on footage, but again, not involved with the scenario at all? They just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Representative Thompson, quickly to the question of your concern.
It was funny that he asked about, my mom used to always say, if was a fifth, we'd always be drunk. So we got a lot of what ifs here. That's one thing. But here's something that is unique about what he's asking about, a naked body. It was just a young man hiding in the dumpster in St. Paul, completely naked. And they asked him to get out of the dumpster. When he got out, not only did they shoot him, they sick him. Dog on him. And so that just came to my mind. He's talking about what if somebody is naked in a video? Would I want it to be released? What I want to be released is the unedited video of wrongdoings of police officers. I don't want this what we have now to allow bad officers to flourish. This is simple acts. And so I hear a lot of what ifs and this and that, but I'm right to the point. This is exactly what we're asking for in these officer-involved shootings. And if you will, Chair, give me one more second just to let Michelle just give her two seconds to elaborate on the what if.
Representative Thompson?
You hear me?
Yes. Did you want to add something or?
Well, you heard nothing I said?
Oh, no, I heard you ask for 2 seconds to.
I was asking, would you allow Michelle Gross 2 seconds?
Ms. Gross.
Yes, thank you. Basically, what I wanted to add is just that under 13.82 subdivision 2, right now there's a wide array of information that is available in police critical incidents and to the public, and the wording is available to the public at all times from the originating agency. So not the BCA, not the prosecutor, but the originating agency. And that, again, it's a long list of data, and it even includes, certain videos, in other words, squad cam videos. But what isn't permitted because of the carve-out that's in 13.825 is body camera footage. So body camera footage is being treated in a very different way. Secondly, I do want to point out that we're not asking that things be released to the general public. We're merely asking for things to be available to the families. And that's a very different ask. And so I want that to be clear to people. And again, recognize that much of this other data is available and pretty much immediately under 13.82 subdivision 2. And that's all I want to point out. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Gross. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair,
I still had one more question.
Representative Lucero, we're going to go to a vote in a few minutes, and so I'm going to ask Representative Frazier to ask the last question, and then we're going to go to a vote, Representative.
And thank you. I appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chair. Okay, well, I'm not satisfied with that, Ann. I'm sorry. Is that for me, or are you recognizing Frazier?
I am.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to quit. It's more of a comment. I think, municipalities right now are not required to have body cameras. I know in the city that I live in, we're going to get body cameras in the next few months as we're moving forward. But I will point out that the body cameras are there to provide information to make sure, so the officers have that information. If something goes down, we have evidence of what happened, right? It can protect the city. But in the same instance, we should be able to provide that information to families that are being impacted by this if there was an error, so they can see that. I think that does kind of create some more of this transparency and trust building that we're trying to do as we look at the kind of police reforms we want to put in place. I think what Rep. Thompson is trying to do is strike the balance there. I've heard him say he's willing to have more conversation around tweaking his language if possible. But I think at the end of the day, he is bringing language forward with these community activists to strike the balance, just to provide that information. The one issue that I think we all should recall and think about is the Laquan McDonald situation that happened in my home city in Chicago. They held that information for over a year. And then when we saw why they held that information. We don't want situations like that here in the state.
Well, Representative Thompson, last 5 seconds, and then we're going to move to a vote.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, everyone, for all this. This is a conversation that's long overdue, Chair, and I don't apologize for having it in your committee. I don't apologize. This is the perfect place to have it. These are hard conversations to have, but keep in mind that the public is who we all serve, and their best interest is always should be our best interest. And so I'm 100% willing to work with everyone on the language, everyone here, and to try to get this right, and some of the tweaks. But I just want to make sure that we get it right. We don't want to have, laws on the books that protect officers and allow them to flourish when they know they should be out. Because these are the officers that make this profession look bad. And I know we don't like for our coworkers making us look bad. And so I just want to just make sure that I reiterate, I want to be able to sit down and have these conversations and work on this together. Thank you, Chair, for having me.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. The Chair renews his motion that House File 1103 as amended be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Nay.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang, excuse.
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Very well. On a vote of 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. And House File 1103 as amended is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you, members, for a good, respectful conversation. Greatly appreciate it. Representative Thompson, you have House File 1104. The chair moves to refer House File 1104 to the Judiciary Committee. You also have an author's amendment that would put the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before us today for debate and consideration. Representative Johnson, we okay with just a voice vote to shape this bill up?
I would rather have a recorded.
All right, so there's a recorded vote. Representative Thompson, can you tell us what the A1 amendment does? And we could turn to council to help. That might be the quickest way to do it.
Yeah, because my computer just shut off over there.
Very well. Let me ask our legal counsel to tell us what the A1 amendment does in this bill.
Mr. Chair, Ben Johnson, House Research.
Mr. Johnson.
The A1 amendment removes the statute of limitations that is in the bill right now. The current statute of limitations identified in the bill is 2 years. Removing this would leave it silent on the statute of limitations. Presumably the standard 6-year statute of limitations that applies to 42 USC 1983 suits now would apply, but it is not explicitly stated.
So we'd leave the 6-year conceivably we would leave the 6-year statute of limitations in place, but it's not speaking directly either way on it. Is that right, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. This would not have an explicit statute of limitations stated here, and so you would be relying on the other statutes of limitations that are currently in law. Federal case law has established that the statute of limitations for claims under the federal law, and this is mirroring the federal law, the limitations there is 6 years. That limitation might apply here. Alternatively, the other statutes of limitations for wrongful death, for sexual assaults, for other torts might apply, and those range anywhere from 3 years for some wrongful death cases to lifetime, depending on the details of a wrongful death or a sexual assault.
Very well. Representative Lucero to the amendment.
It is, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I just wanted to ask, okay, given that, I was getting very concerned there that, because I heard maybes and mights and it may apply, but I'm not entirely confident then on what the definitive change might be if this amendment were to be adopted. So, but let's just take those for granted, those, as we just heard, the various statutes of limitations. So my question for the bill author then, or the amendment author actually, would be why expand the statute of limitations to 6 or potentially a lifetime, depending on the fact pattern, versus a 2-year, which is presently in the bill.
Representative Thompson.
Here, can I defer that to Representative Hollins?
Representative Hollins? I believe this is language Representative Hollins worked out with you at some point. Representative Hollins?
I worked on this at the request of particular advocates to remove it. I believe the idea was behind removing the statute of limitations is because there's another bill that is before us that would remove the statute of limitations entirely for wrongful death. And so in order to not conflict with the limit of statute of limitations with that. That's the reason they wanted to have it removed. That's my understanding. I would defer to Jonathan McClellan for a further explanation.
Mr. McClellan, are you still with us?
I am. That is correct. The idea behind removing the statute, the 2-year statute of limitations, is that it would conflict with a bill that was already passed by this committee. And that's why we removed that.
Very well. Representative O'Neill?
Well, Mr. Chair, what bill is that? What bill is being referred to?
Representative Lucero?
What bill? I heard references to a bill, but what exactly bill are they referring to, and what does that bill do that they're referring to? That they're saying that would potentially conflict, that they're trying to line up. What bill? What's the House file number?
Mr. McClellan, do you know what that bill is about?
Yes, that's the statute, ending statute of limitations on wrongful death, House file 717, and Senate file is 202021.
Very well. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair, you know how much I hate language that is unclear. And we don't know if that other bill 717 will become law or not. So we can't change this based solely on that, because that's not how we do things. But Mr. Chair, I would like to hear directly from the author of the bill and the author of the amendment. What is his intention? Is his intention, by removing this language of statutory limitations to 2 years, is it to make it without limitation? Is that his intent? Or is it something else? Because it sounds like it's very unclear.
That is my intent, you're correct.
Representative Thompson.
Yes, Chair, I'm sorry. That is my intent, you're correct.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, for the sake of clarity, maybe he should amend his amendment so that it is very clear what his intent is, because we have no idea what's going to happen with 717. And I think that it needs to be clear what he's doing and what his intent is, because right now it's really unclear.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, members, my thinking here is that if you're concerned about this amendment because you think it's going to make the bill worse, if you were planning to vote for the bill, I mean, I guess what I'd say is we have a general courtesy that we allow bill authors to present the bills in the form they wish. If that makes it less likely you're going to vote for the bill, then you can take that into account when you have your final vote. I'll simply note that what I heard from Mr. Johnson, and based on my experience too, is that we don't necessarily spell out in situations necessarily precisely what the statute of limitations is. So the fact that that's being removed in this case, it's simply then going to have other principles that apply, which is true in all kinds of situations in the law. So we've got nothing unusual going on here. And I'll also just note that the bill that was referenced was actually heard in the Judiciary Committee. And so if there's concerns about this, really, I would suggest that those can be addressed as the bill moves forward. But in any case, I think we should show the author the courtesy of allowing him simply to present the bill in the form that he wishes. Thank you.
It's good advice, Representative Pinto. Members, I allowed some space here in order to have an explanation, but I've got now 5 or 6 members who want to debate whether or not the author can shape the bill up and present it before you for an up or down vote the way that author wishes it. And so, quite frankly, members, the common courtesy we afford to one another across the aisle should hold for Representative Thompson just as it would hold for any other member of this body. And so, a roll being called, the clerk will take the roll on the A1 amendment.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorne?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorne, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, nay.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
No.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Nay.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Members, with a vote of 11 ayes and 8 nays, the author's amendment is adopted. The bill is now shaped up before us the way the author wants us to debate the bill. Representative Thompson, you have a couple of testifiers, Mr. McClellan, and I believe Gregory Sisk. And so let me ask Mr. McClellan to come forward quickly, and then Mr. Sisk immediately following. Mr. McClellan, please state your name for the record, by the way.
Yes, again, my name is Jonathan McClellan. I'm the president of the Minnesota Justice Coalition. I would like to thank Representative Thompson for carrying this historic piece of legislation. In the Civil Rights Act of 1871, Congress, an elected representative of the people, gave Americans the right to sue public officials who violate their rights. Congress said that if a public official violates your rights, whether via police brutality or an illegal search or unlawful arrest, you can file a lawsuit to hold that public official financially accountable for his conduct. Congress made it possible to seek redress in the courts. In 1967, a year before the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the Supreme Court invented qualified immunity in a case called Pearson versus Ray, describing it as a modest exception for public officials who had acted in good faith and believed that their conduct was authorized by law. In 1982, in Harlow versus Fitzgerald, the court expanded the defense. The protection afforded to public officials would no longer turn on whether the officials acted in good faith. Now even officials who violate people's rights maliciously would be immune unless a victim can show his or her right was clearly established. To show that the law is clearly established, the court has said a victim must point to a previously decided case that involves the same specific context and particular conduct, unless the victim can point to a judicial decision that happened to involve the same context and conduct, the officer will be shielded from liability. The Supreme Court has recognized one exception to this rule in Hope v. Pilzer. There, corrections officers disciplined a prisoner by handcuffing him to a hitching post for 7 hours with his hands above his shoulders, shirtless in the summer sun. At one point, a guard taunted the prisoner by giving water to a guard dog in plain sight. Faced with these circumstances and no prior case that had confronted similar facts, the Supreme Court ruled that the officer's cruelty was so obvious that they should have had fair warning, and their conduct violated the constitutional protection against cruel and unusual punishment. Far from creating meaningful exception, however, courts frequently consider the circumstances and hope to set the threshold for how egregious an officer's behavior must be before considering to have fair warning, and this is how law is today. Qualified immunity chills the constitutional rights of citizens. Qualified immunity freezes constitutional law. As mentioned previously, in order to overcome the defense of qualified immunity, a victim must show that law enforcement violated clearly established law by pointing to a case arising in the same context and involving the same conduct. This has given courts a shortcut to resolving cases. Instead of reviewing, analyzing, and applying the constitutional doctrine to determine whether a person's rights were violated, the court can instead simply say that there has been no specifically similar cases in the past. The result is that fewer courts ever resolve constitutional issues, and constitutional rights are hardly ever clearly established. Qualified immunity is not a law created by an elected body such as Congress or a state legislature. It is the duty of an elected body to enact law and the courts to interpret the law. This has happened in our history before, where the courts invented a doctrine that harmed a now protected class of people. U.S. Chief Justice Roger Taney invented a doctrine of substantive due process, a complete contradiction in terms, and used it to extend slavery throughout all the United States territory. Chief Justice Taney was known for one of the worst court decisions in U.S. history in Dred Scott case. Along with other events in the 1960s, elected officials rose to the challenge and enacted the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. courts are not allowed to make law. That is the job of a duly elected body represented by the people. Qualified immunity means that victims of brutality or harassment by law enforcement generally get no relief in the court and have no ability to hold offending officers accountable for their actions. Ending qualified immunity would mean a place where government makes sure their employees follow the Constitution and their oaths to the Constitution's meaning. Ending qualified immunity would change structural incentives for government at all levels, encouraging them to take more responsibility for their actions of their employees and ensure best hiring practices. For police, ending qualified immunity might include providing de-escalation training and instituting robust use of force policies that help our police departments evolve. Qualified immunity lowers the standard of liability lower than any other profession. Qualified immunity has created deep mistrust between communities and law enforcement. The loss of trust means crimes are often unreported and community members refrain from stepping forward to assist law enforcement. A fear tactic used is that rampant lawsuits against police would be the result of ending qualified immunity, and they're overblown. Many municipalities indemnify their officers, meaning that the city pays for any settlement, not the officers themselves. Another fear tactic used is that prohibiting qualified immunity will cause officers to second guess their actions. Police officers' actions should be based on their training, and their training based on following the Constitution and state law. And we want good officers who follow the law, not make excuses to get around it. Qualified immunity sends the message that police are not above the law because nobody is above the law. In a case that came before the 11th Circuit, the police officer shot a 10-year-old while trying to shoot a non-threatening family dog. The 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals held that the officer was entitled to qualified immunity because no earlier case held it was unconstitutional for a police officer to recklessly discharge his gun into a group of children without justification. The court also declined to establish that rule. Not only was the officer let off the hook in that case, but the very same officer could act the same way again and would still be entitled to qualified immunity. In Kane versus Barger in 2018, Officer Shane Barger was dispatched to a hospital to interview a sexual assault victim. A physician had already taken photographs of the victim's injuries during a medical examination. During the interview, Barger instructed the victim to come to the police department with the clothes she was wearing at the time of the assault. Upon the police department, Barger took the victim alone to a back room and photographed intimate areas of her body. The victim claimed that Barger touched her upper chest and her buttocks as he photographed her with his personal cell phone. Barger questioned the victim about her breast, vagina, buttocks, persistently asking whether she sustained injuries to her vagina. Though she repeatedly denied having visible injuries, Barger relentless questioning led her to show it to him. Barger initially lied to investigators about using his cell phone to photograph the victim. After further questioning, he admitted he had lied, explaining he didn't want his girlfriend to be jealous of the photos. Barger was disciplined for violating department policy, and he only received a 2-week suspension. The victim then sued Officer Barger, alleging he touched and photographed her for his own gratification, and a district court granted qualified immunity to Barger, ruling that the right to be free from violation of bodily integrity was not clearly established. In Jessup versus City of Fresno, Ninth Circuit granted immunity to police officers who were alleged to have stolen $225,000 in cash and rare coins while executing a search warrant. Obviously, these officers were not acting in good faith, and no one contended otherwise. But the court said that while the theft of personal property by police officers sworn to uphold the law may be morally wrong, the officers couldn't be sued for their theft because that particular appellate court had never specifically decided whether the theft of property covered by the terms of a search warrant and seized pursuant to that warrant violates the Fourth Amendment. So because there was no prior case involving such outlandishly illegal misconduct, the officers received qualified immunity. An officer who knowingly violates someone's constitutional rights. Did someone say something?
No, can you just wrap up? We're running out of time. Thank you.
Yep. An officer who knowingly violates someone's constitutional rights will generally be protected from suit unless the victim can identify previous judicial opinions that address the specific context and conduct. This is is very far afield from what Congress sought to achieve in the Civil Rights Act. Instead of considering whether a person's civil rights have been violated, and if so, providing the victim with a remedy, courts shut their doors to victims simply because no prior judicial opinion happened to involve the same facts. On March 3rd, 2021, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act in H.R. 1280 in the 117th Congress. As part of this act, qualified immunity was included. As I've stated in my previous testimony, there is no silver bullet for fixing the deep wounds needed around criminal justice reform, but supporting this bill sends a mighty powerful statement that we are a nation of laws founded on constitutional principles of which we all benefit as Americans, and it is what separates us from any other country in the world. This is our Dred Scott moment. The state of Minnesota looks to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Mr. Professor Sisk, I'm afraid we have very little time. I apologize to you, sir, but if you could identify yourself for the record and give us some very brief guidance, testimony, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Gregory Sisk, and I hold the Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of St. Thomas. I'm speaking only for myself and not on behalf of the university. I want to highlight the growing scholarly consensus that qualified immunity is illegitimate and has been an abysmal failure as a legal doctrine. And I will be very brief, so this is only a summary. Qualified immunity has failed as history. Professor William Baud at the University of Chicago and Professor James Fander at Northwestern have done the historical research to show there was never a good faith exception that allowed officials to ignore the Constitution. Qualified immunity has failed as constitutional law. It has hollowed out constitutional rights, leaving some victims of unconstitutional official misconduct without any remedy. And qualified immunity has failed as protection for police acting reasonably. Police officers who are acting in difficult and dangerous situations already receive broad and deferential treatment under reasonableness provisions in the Constitution. As Professor Joan Schwartz of UCLA showed in an empirical study, eliminating qualified immunity will not open the floodgates to many more lawsuits. Qualified immunity is a subject on which legal scholars across the spectrum have come together to recognize the failure. We legal scholars hotly debate issues with one another, and seldom do we reach a consensus. This is that exceptional scenario. Law professors who belong to the liberal-leaning American Constitution Society, law professors who advocate major structural changes in public safety, and other law professors like myself who belong to the Federalist Society and who oppose defunding the police find themselves coming together. We share a scholarly and intellectual agreement that qualified immunity is legally wrong and does not work. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Sisk, for your very concise and powerful testimony. With that, Representative Thompson, there are two testifiers that wish to come from the public. Ritual Chief Hepler, welcome back. State your name for the record. Give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Jay Henthorn, Chief of Police of Richfield again. Thank you, members. On behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, we oppose House File 1104. In the effort to save time, though, I want to add that we spoke with Representative Hollins about her bill, House File 440, and her amendment, and appreciate moving to a study group on this issue. House File 1104 would totally upend case law and erode the qualified immunity standard that has protected officers and municipalities against frivolous lawsuits for years. We have a lot of questions about how this bill, if passed in the law, would function. We have heard that this bill is about accountability, but in practice, all this would do is lead to every officer having to purchase their own insurance policy, which at this point, we don't even know if it's available on the private marketplace right now. This would shift costs to the taxpayers, as the cost is likely to be borne by cities and counties, either directly or indirectly. If the legislature wants to make a difference in holding officers accountable, you should join us in fixing a broken arbitration process and allow CLEOs, like myself, to better hold bad officers accountable. It should be noted that this idea was brought up at one point, but was not put forward as a recommendation due to significant problems that it would create. Lastly, the bill would have a significant impact on our ability to recruit and retain officers in a time where we are struggling to find new recruits, not to mention recruits that reflect the diversity of our communities. Qualified immunity does not protect a law enforcement officer who knowingly violates that law. And eliminating that immunity as a defense would inevitably open up police officers to unwarranted lawsuits, where all cases will potentially go to trial, where judges and or juries could then pick apart split-second decisions after a lengthy, costly discovery, litigation, trials, and appeals. Even when the officers eventually prevail in court, this will result in significant financial costs for cities, police officers, and ultimately local taxpayers who will foot the bill. Talking with my staff in my department about this just last week, and I'm sure other CLEOs have as well, this will impact, again, the ability to retain, recruit, and train officers, as it would no longer be offered any legal protections against lawsuits. On anecdotal data, my department is 32% people of color. My community roughly represents 38% people of color. My BIPOC officers have come to me and expressed to me their concerns of not being able or unwilling to work in a profession without qualified immunity or having to take out professional liability insurance. Many of our officers are supporting their parents and siblings, who in my department are mostly Latino, are undocumented and struggling financially. This is going on throughout the state as we try to recruit and retain officers of diversity within our departments. So as the Minnesota Chiefs of Police, we strongly oppose House File 1104, and we thank you for the opportunity to testify here today.
Thank you, Chief, and I do appreciate the work you've done to diversify your police department. I also appreciate your work on arbitration over the last few years as well. We then have Sheriff Leslie again. Sheriff, please come forward, state your name, and give us your brief testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. It's Tim Leslie, Dakota County Sheriff, and thank you again for letting me testify today. I'm involved in the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I represent them today in opposition of 1104, but I wanted to reach out to Representative Tom and tell him that nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop. So I share that with you, and my responsibility as sheriff to rid ourselves should we have one in our midst. This has some unintended consequences, 1104, that I want to raise. It doesn't address off-duty circumstances. Law enforcement executives, we don't want our deputies or our police officers getting involved in conduct while of law enforcement while they're out to dinner with their families. We want them to be good witnesses, call 911, and get out of the way. Too many cases in off-duty circumstances have turned bad, so we don't want them getting involved in off-duty conduct like that. The other unintended effect is recruitment. Like Chief Henthorn said, it impacts our employers. Union issues, cost issues to local governments, an increase in lawsuits, not to mention whether insurance carriers would even offer these for us as well. We're already having a terrible time in recruiting. My friend and colleague, Kelly McCarthy, chair of the Post Board and chief of Mendota Heights, she had a whopping 12 applicants for an open police officer position last week. That's not healthy for the organizations that we work in. It's not healthy for the profession. We want a big, thick cream of the crop, not a really thin layer. There's a misnomer that law enforcement feels like qualified immunity is some get-out-of-jail-free card. The attorneys I talk to say there's nothing further from the truth. The realities are qualified immunity does not protect law enforcement who knowingly violate the law. The view is that law enforcement is protected by qualified immunity. We feel is overstated, and we want to support that and remain in support of those concepts as qualified immunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. Members, there are no other testifiers. We have several members with questions and comments that would ask each of them to be extremely brief, out of respect for one another, also for our ability to move through the rest of the bills here. Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, in listening to some of the testifiers, I'd just like to say one thing. Until you put on that badge and walk the street and walk the line, you don't know what goes on out there, and you don't know how fast a decision has to be made.
and you don't know the things that officers deal with. When I look at the sheriff just answered one of the questions or just informed us of one of the things that in a wrongful death or if an officer breaks the law, they are not covered under this immunity. They're not covered by it. So if there's a wrongful death, you know, what you're doing with this bill, I mean, I hear from members from the other side, we support the good cops. We support the good cops. We want the good cops. But you're throwing all of the good cops under the bus by taking away this immunity. Those are the officers that are standing up and doing the job, upholding the Constitution, upholding laws, upholding people's rights. This is not a failure because these officers are doing what is right, good, and just to protect their neighbors. So looking at this bill and listening to the testifiers, the chief and the sheriff, in reference to all officers, doesn't matter what color they are, all officers are looking at this going, what the heck's going on here? Do they not, for the author then, is it your intent, is it the intent of this bill to completely do away with law enforcement officers, period? Because that is what this is pushing towards. Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, if you'd answer that question, please.
Representative Grassl, that's a rhetorical question. We want to get into the technical aspects of whether this bill can work or not. That's the purpose of this committee. I really want us to stay focused on that. I know there are strong feelings. I said that at the very beginning. I do not want this committee to turn into an exchange of those strong feelings used against one another. There were law enforcement folks just currently in this committee who said they don't want bad officers either. And so, you know, let's keep it to the issue before us and not the intent in terms of this overall question. Representative Grassl, I'm going to give you a few seconds to wrap up, and then you've got four other colleagues that wish to comment as well. Representative Grassl.
Mr. Chair, I try to keep a good focus and keep a good dialogue going all the time.
I appreciate that.
And bringing a bill like this into this committee, you, Mr. Chair, have essentially fanned the flames on a lot of these things.
Representative,
because that is what this bill is doing, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grassl.
It is chasing good law enforcement officers away from a profession that is in dire need of good officers.
Representative Grassl, I appreciate your opinion. It's on the record. Let's move forward. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the sake of brevity, I do have multiple questions, but I will I'd just be concise with one. So I see, and my question is to the bill author, on both lines, there's two instances of a phrase, both on lines 1.7 and on 2.2. Could the bill author, I'm looking for the bill author, to please clarify for me his intent and his understanding of his use of the words color of law?
Representative Thompson, and that is a term, it is a legal term, and perhaps if you're looking for a definition of it, you might want to ask our legal counsel.
Whoever can answer the question.
Legal counsel, the phrase color of law in statutory language.
Mr. Chair, Ben Johnson with House Research. Mr. Chair and members, the term color of law is not specifically defined in Minnesota statute, but this comes directly from federal law. It's nearly identical to the federal law that I mentioned earlier, 42 USC 1983. There's very clear interpretation of that that presumably would also be applied to this statute. Essentially, it means someone acting apparently under the official duties and responsibilities of a state or other government actor. The phrase under color of law is written that way to suggest that someone may be acting in a way that is not actually consistent with their responsibilities and duties, but gives the appearance that they are acting in that official capacity.
I appreciate that. I just learned a few things. Good question, Representative.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And because it isn't defined in state statute, then, is that the bill author's intent? And I guess I'm not understanding what color, and maybe that's more of a historical question, but because it isn't statutorily defined in Minnesota, what is the bill author's intent then with that?
I believe the bill author's intent is to reference federal law. Representative Thompson?
100% accurate. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Thompson, members. As Representative Grossel pointed out, this bill is not about public safety. This committee is the public safety committee. We've always had, it's either public safety, policy, finance, something else on the end, but this is public safety. Number one priority is about the safety of the public. Law enforcement does their best to do that. They work very hard. Mr. McKillen testified a number of things. I was looking up a number of them. I don't think any of them happened in Minnesota. Now, the sheriffs did point out that in his testimony about qualified immunity, as long as the officer is not breaking a law or violating the law or policy for that matter, he's protected. But if he violates policy, violates the law, qualified immunity does not fall in play. He is liable for what he does. And part of the reason for qualified immunity is because of if a city or even us as legislators pass a law that is enforced by law enforcement officers or the city or a county, say, an ordinance, and the officers are enforcing it, and that is found unconstitutional, the ordinance or law that we passed, the officers, because they arrested somebody or charged them out or detained them, could be sued. Because not but what they did, but because they were following policy or the law. That's what qualified immunity is for. Now, the issues that were brought up by the previous testifier, the first testifier on this bill, those are the outliers. I have a feeling that once it's looked into, there's going to be a lot more information coming out on that one that was not relayed to us. That's unfortunately how things work here. This bill is dangerous to the public safety, to the safety of the public of Minnesota. And the only reason to have a bill like this is the same reason they did it in Nancy Pelosi and they did it in U.S. Congress, is to end local control and local police departments. Back in Ramsey County, they've already been petitioning.
Representative Johnson, go ahead. To the bill, please.
This is to the bill. This is what this bill does.
Representative Johnson, there's no reference to Nancy Pelosi in this bill. To the bill.
This is the same thing that was gone through with the federal. This was in the federal bill that was passed on the House of Representatives. Now, this bill is dangerous to the safety of the public. I don't know what Representative Thompson's motives for this, whether it's to end law enforcement as we know it,
or
lend law enforcement as...
Representative Johnson, to the bill and not to the intentions of the author, the intentions of the author, the intention of the bill itself.
Well, what this bill will do is this will end local law enforcement. So I cannot support this. It's dangerous. We already heard testimony that where we normally get the 100 to 150 applicants for law enforcement officers, they have 12. You don't get the best officers. In a recent survey, only 11% of 10,000 officers across the country would recommend law enforcement. Minnesota has always been the number one recruitment where other states come to get our educated people because of the training they receive here. This is going to destroy that. And this, I believe, bills like this are detriment to the safety of the public, safety of the of our citizens, and going to make more victims in Minnesota instead of less. And with that, I would suggest a no vote on this bill and actually find the nearest trash can for it. Thank you.
Representative Long.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. The rhetoric on this bill is really incredible, so I just want to bring us back a little bit to what this bill does, which is prevent law enforcement officers from violating individuals' constitutional and civil rights. And I think Representative Grossel put it well. He said that good cops don't violate people's rights and they uphold the Constitution. And that is what this bill is designed to do, is to allow officers who are violating the Constitution and violating civil rights to be held accountable. And we know, I think Mr. McClellan spelled out very clearly that the case law here is that clearly established is not whether or not an individual is violating someone's civil rights or their constitutional rights, not even whether it's very plain that they're doing so in some of the examples that Mr. McClellan gave. It's just whether a court has said so previously. And so to my conservative friends across the aisle, I would just try to look at the conservative argument here, which is that you are allowing judicial activism to trump constitutional text, which are the individual constitutional rights of all American citizens, are being trumped here by whether or not a court in a particular jurisdiction has made a particular finding on a particular set of facts. And that is what we're talking about here, not ending police departments. Colorado has passed this. They still have police departments. We're talking about constitutional rights. So I'm hoping we can keep our focus there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Raleigh, Representative Hollins, and then we're going to move to a vote. Representative
Raleigh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. If I'd call the author's attention to line 1.8. In that, it said, failing to intervene another person to the deprivation of, and I've highlighted, any rights. Now, in order to understand the word any rights, we've got to go to 1.6, which says, notwithstanding any law to the contrary. So the Constitution of the United States of America and Minnesota says that we each have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I'm just going to focus specifically on liberty. With the construction of this language, specifically going into any rights, and then there's another one in here that says, but not limited to. And I really think that those two things in conjunction with each other have to be taken together. So my question to the author is, with the new construction of this law, would the deprivation of a person's right to liberty, meaning walking freely about, be usurped by them being arrested underneath the color of the law of this particular bill? Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson.
Chair, I want to defer that question to the professor.
Professor Sisk.
Thank you, Chair. The answer to that is absolutely no. This makes no change in the basic application of the current rules that govern appropriate behavior by law enforcement. Let me say that, if I may, Chair, that I have very much appreciated the comments of the sheriff and of the chief and of many representatives. And in fact, I agree with everything that they say, except for the conclusion. And the mistaken conclusion is that qualified immunity supports these principles. It does not. Empirical research has shown that only 3.9% of civil rights cases against police officers are dismissed on qualified immunity grounds. So we are not talking about a huge increase. In addition, as Representative Long correctly pointed out, qualified immunity is not about whether the Constitution has been violated. It's about whether a prior court had specifically addressed those particular facts. And so if I could conclude by just pointing to one case that the Supreme Court has decided that really illustrates this. Mullinex versus Luna, involving an individual who was in a car fleeing from the police. It was at night in a rural area where there was no one at risk, no businesses at risk. The spike strips had been laid down. The car was moving towards them. The police officer's superior said, stay, do not act, do not fire your weapon. But he fired multiple shots in the dark with no training, killing the individual, and then told his superior, well, how's that for being proactive? The Supreme Court held that qualified immunity protected that officer, not because he had complied with the Constitution, he plainly had not, but because the court had not previously addressed exactly those set of facts in a prior case. The court never even reached the constitutional question. Qualified immunity is wrongful because it sends the message that the Constitution is hollow, that violating the Constitution has no consequences. Qualified immunity does not impair any officer who acts within a broad scope of reasonableness that the Supreme Court has granted to police officers acting in dangerous situations.
Very well. Representative Hollins, then we're going to move to a vote.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to follow up on that.
Representative Rowley, I just don't have the time. We're about to get kicked out of here. Representative Hollins?
I'll be very brief. I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank Representative Thompson. You know, for my Republican colleagues, I have a number of people in my district who are asking me to defund the police and who are actively petitioning me to do this. And what I see this bill is doing is finding a happy medium between what we currently have and this far left version of defunding the police. And so with that in mind, I would ask that you look at this with a little bit of with open mind and open heart, because especially with some of the testimony that we've heard today saying that this is not where qualified immunity applies, this is not how it works, if it doesn't have that broad of an application, if it doesn't affect a lot of these things that we're saying, then why are we so afraid of getting rid of it? So I implore the other side of the aisle to look at this not as a knee-jerk reaction, but really think it through and talk to your constituents about it. Thank you.
Very well. Representative Thompson, the chair renews his motion that House File 1104 as amended. First to the Committee on Judiciary, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, no.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston.
Nay.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 11 ayes and 8 nays.
With 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1104 as amended is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Members, I'm going to push it until they pull the switch, which could happen at any moment. But Representative Wolgamon, you're not a member of this committee, and you've been waiting patiently. We're going to lay your bill over, but we want to give an opportunity for you to be heard. The chair moves to refer House File 1535 to the General Register. Representative Wolgamon, very briefly, sir, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Members, and I apologize, my internet connection is terrible here at the state office building, so my camera will be off. I'm here to present House File 1535. I do have an author's amendment, if you would like me to address that first, Mr. Chair.
The chair moves to amend House File 1535 with the A21 amendment. Representative Wolgamon, what does your amendment do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The original bill placed state and local corrections officers under the statute that controls disciplinary procedures for peace officers and repealed the correctional officers statute. I heard from parties representing state correctional officers indicate that they would rather stay where they're at now. Therefore, this amendment leaves the state correctional officers under the correctional officers statute, which is no longer being repealed by this bill.
Very well. So you're deferring to our correction officers. Representative Johnson, voice vote okay with this?
I would actually have a question on this amendment.
Very quickly, Representative Johnson.
I am just wondering why they're removing the State Department of Corrections out of this.
Representative Wongamott.
Again, that just is no longer the scope of this legislation.
Representative Johnson.
I'm wondering why. We have corrections officers not only at the county level, but we have the state level. I think they should be afforded the same authority. We do that along with our peace officers. What doesn't matter if they're fugitive apprehension unit, BCA, or our local police departments. We treat them all the same. Why are we not treating our corrections officers in our county jails and our state prisons the same?
Representative Wongamott, I believe you said this was at their request, Representative Wongamott.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Yep, I'm taking the word of corrections officers that they know better what they would like than I do.
Very well. Representative Johnson, I believe that answers your question. Can we do a voice call? Do you want a roll call on this amendment?
I'll do a roll call on this.
Very well. The clerk will take the roll on the 21 amendment.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny?
In the spirit of the chair's request, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Nay.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 13 ayes and 6 nays.
13 ayes and 6 nays. The motion prevails. The 21 amendment is adopted. Thank you for the bipartisan votes, members. It's quite frankly, personally, I believe it's bad form for any committee not to allow an author to shape the bill the way that the author wishes it to be before us. It's a courtesy that we absolutely ought to be offering, extending to one another, regardless of partisan, or rather party affiliation. Representative Wongamott, super quickly.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill addresses disciplinary procedures involving corrections officers. It places correctional officers under the same procedural fairness rules as peace officers. Presently, there are two statutes regulating these procedures. These correctional officers statute only addresses about one third of the issues addressed in the peace officer statute. Since peace officers and correctional officers often face the same situations with the same requirements, there's no reason to have a different set of procedural requirements for their internal disciplinary procedures. These procedures involved in these statutes do not include criminal investigations. And again, as I mentioned, the Department of Corrections and some people representing state employees had a few concerns about the bill, indicated they would rather stay where they're at for now. The amendment that we passed addressed that. I would add that that amendment was passed over in the Senate. And I want to echo the chair's sentiments that it is kind of insulting to have my author's amendment be voted against. But anyway, we have Adam Burnside from Law Enforcement Labor Services with us today to testify and answer any questions.
Welcome, Mr. Burnside. We only have a few seconds. If you could please identify yourself and state your name for the record. I do apologize, sir, for not giving you the time that you you rightly deserve. Welcome. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Adam Burnside. I'm a business agent with Law Enforcement Labor Services. We're the largest statewide union representing law enforcement, correction agencies, 911 dispatchers, firefighters, medical examiners. And I'm just here to support the providing of correction officers with the same procedural protections afforded to law enforcement officers, police officers. They both work with the public, and they both are subject to, from time to time, complaints from the public for misconduct. But that's where the two diverge. For a police officer, those complaints must be signed. The officer must be given a written summary of the allegation. They must be afforded representation. Those things, so same protections don't apply to correction officers. So for some correction officers in the 87 counties of Minnesota, they can be brought in by a supervisor, not told what they're being questioned about, have no preparation, have no representation, and could potentially have, have their livelihood put in jeopardy without having that representation. And so we're just looking to have equal treatment for correction officers as peace officers. And I will note that some counties, Crow Wing County, Stearns County, Carlton County, currently do treat correction officers the same as peace officers because they prefer to have one singular process in place instead of having separate procedures for different law enforcement personnel. And I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Burnside. My apologies again, but thank you for your testimony. Members, we are out of time. The chair lays over House File 1535 as amended, and this committee is adjourned until tomorrow.